All right, why don't we get started up again? Welcome back, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your light snacks and conversations out in the lobby. Looking at the agenda, we will be moving on to interpretive notices. Then we'll have a member panel specifically on risk management. And we'll finish off the day with common exam findings and how to prepare for an NFA exam. In our next panel, we have Rena Callisto. We have Michael Jan and Julio Reed for our interpretive notice session.
So good morning. I'd like to thank everyone for coming out here this morning. My name is Julio Reed. I am the cybersecurity manager for both the Chicago and New York locations, as well as for the futures and OTC swaps area. I'll be covering the cybersecurity area. If you have any questions while I'm going through some of the slides, feel free to ask. Or if you have any particular topics you want to discuss in detail, I will be available throughout the entire workshop for any detailed discussions. So we got a lot of area to cover. We're going to go ahead and get started. So the definition of cybersecurity. From an industry standpoint, cybersecurity basically means the protection and prevention of information from being unauthorized access. For our sake, this is going to be in reference to protection of the firm's investor information. And this is the context we're going to go through in that regards throughout the cyber review session. Cybersecurity. In regards to the compromise, normally compromise is in reference to the three or maybe a combination of those three areas, what they technically called in the cyber industry area, CIA. Integrity, availability, and confidentiality. For our discussion, or for my particular discussion, normally I will have a secondary person, but since I'm doing this on my own, for my discussion, I will be focusing on the particular business areas as noted before. In reference to broker-dealers, investment companies, registered investment advisors, and now transfer agents, which is a recent update that was made by the SEC in May 15, 2024. NFA actually has put together an interpretive notice, and I'm sure everyone here is quite familiar with it. Interpretive Notice 9070, which is in reference to Information System Security Program. I will be going into that particular interpretive in detail. My colleague, Michael Jan, will be discussing the Interpretive Notice 9079 in greater detail as well. We look for our members to make sure they actually understand the interpretive notice. And if there are any questions that you might have where there's any obscurity in regards to some of the information within the notice, feel free to ask me. So the interpretive notice applies to all NFA membership categories, that being the CPOs, CPAs, FCMs, and IBs, and all the areas that are registered within NFA. The interpretive notice itself requires members to adopt and enforce an ISSP appropriate to their circumstances and secure both customer data and access to electronic information. Some of my prior colleagues that were up here earlier who were discussing, making sure that you understand the interpretive notice is a item that is created to one size that fit all. Regardless of the size of your operation, the interpretive notice can be applied in great detail. It must be approved in writing, and needless to say, you're going to see this fairly often. We look for all of our members to have the actual interpretive notice to be in written format. Must be appropriate to member security risks. Basically, we look for our members to conduct a detailed risk assessment of their technology operations and identify what appropriate safeguards should be applied in reference to any particular data that is considered critical or PII information. It should be able to provide an overview and guidance regarding information security practices member firms should adopt and tailor to their business activities. Certain minimum ISSP requirements. This varies during our examination, where for some small firms, we don't look for them to have certain specific activities, such as some of the larger members. Say, for instance, if we are looking at the threat and vulnerability activity, we don't look for some of the smaller members to actually have a very detailed threat vulnerability plan or an actual application or a particular SIEM area, which is a security event and incident monitoring group that manages all security events. However, we look for them to have some form of oversight in regards to managing and identifying any threats that are located within their firms. It requires that cyber risks posed by critical third-party providers be addressed in the member's security risk assessment. We understand that some firms actually outsource a number of their cyber operations, particularly some of the smaller firms. We recognize that they might not have the in-house subject matter expertise, nor would they actually have the budget to incorporate a subject matter expert or oversight in that area. That being the case, we actually turn to the members to make sure that they extend the requirements within the Interpretive Notice 9070 to those third-party providers. Ideally, we recommend that this is outlined within the service level agreement or the statement of work or master contracts that you have with your third-party vendors. Ideally, it will be beneficial for you to hold frequent meetings with certain third-party personnel if you are they're managing any critical or PII information. One of the key things that we look for some of the members in managing their third-party members is that we recognize some of these third parties are probably leveraging some form of AI activity, which we'll discuss in greater detail going forward, that you fully understand if you're leveraging any AI add-on features from a third-party vendors. You need to fully understand what data that third-party is actually utilizing and how that data is being transposed, stored, or processed on their end. The interpretive notice also looks at various other activities that we review, such as patch management or software updates, password management, identity access management as a whole, user access and deletion and transfers. We also look at software development lifecycle change management activity, just to name a few. We also have within the Interpretive Notice 9070 a actual embedded link, if you were to go to the website, that actually has an FAQ to provide detailed information related to any particular questions that we found most of our members have had and provided to us. It also provides additional links to certain industry references and resources that you can utilize, such as in creation of your ISSP program or policy, as well as providing and creating any form of training program that you have within your organization. So this slide I will probably spend a majority of my time with. This is in reference to some of the areas that we found to be consistent during our examinations and finding. The first would be lack of documented ISSP. As I had stated before, we noticed that a number of our firms actually have a documented policy, but in some regards, it seems to be incomplete or inconsistent. That being that it's fairly brief. If you have a one-page ISSP and you're actually more of a middle to a larger firm, we're going to scrutinize that it needs to be have a little bit more context to some of the areas that's noted within the interpretive notice. And the same goes if you actually have information mainly related to incident response planning and possibly password management, and that's pretty much the extent of the ISSP, we look for you to detail out other areas that's noted within our interpretive and outline that within the policy as well. Performing security risk analysis. Most security measures in regards to encryption, password protection, and multi-factor authentication. Depending on the size of your firm and the type of information you house or transmit, it's important for you to plan to include these data loss protections. So this goes back to the risk assessment process that I had referenced earlier. Once you have identified any particular critical information or PII information, we look for you to apply the appropriate security controls or safeguards in regards to that. This could reference, just for example, password management, multi-factor authentication, or single sign-on activity. Another finding we see is non-enforced cyber training. Cyber training is something we look for our members to apply to all staff members, regardless of their position with the firm. A good example, a good base mark to use by is that if any staff member utilizes a computer system and they transpose any information within the firm or even outside the firm, this could be someone ranging from the CEO all the way to an admin person, it's important that you put them through cybersecurity training in regards to certain particular information that is appropriate that they to be trained on in relation to your business operations. We're seeing more and more members who are not appropriately recording cybersecurity training activities, or some firms who are actually extending training to be 90 or 120 days. Certain members, when we conduct our examinations, we find that some of the managers are sometimes lose sight that if the person actually has that length of time to complete the training, they lose track of the member, and sometimes it turns into that they don't actually complete the training within the time they need it once they reach a new hire within the firm. So any new hires, we look for them to complete the training ideally during orientation or through any kind of initial training that they go through upon coming on the firm. For staff members who've been with the firm longer than 1 year, we look for them to complete the cyber training within a 1 year calendar year period. This includes whatever calendar year you roll by, if it's from August to August or from January to January. Regardless, all staff members are required to complete the training within that time period and show proof that they had completed that training, whether it be from a log or any kind of certification they obtain from any CBT computer-based training program. Another common finding that we see firms is not performing an assessment of threats posed by critical third-party service providers as it relates to cybersecurity. I'm not going to go into too much detail related to the third party. As I stated before, my colleague Michael Jan will go into greater detail on that. However, we look for firms to actually document and make sure they keep in step with any particular third party member that they actually have risk ranked to be most critical or critical, and that they maintain a good rapport with them, a periodic meeting with them, to make sure that they are in step with any updates of any outstanding threats that's out there in the industry. Our last common finding is insufficient incident response plans. This area, we've seen some few areas, but it's a critical area that I feel that I want to make noted to all members. It's ideal to actually have an incident response plan in place. We've actually had some firms where they've actually experienced significant breaches, and I'll go into greater detail of that during my session, where they actually had somewhat of an incomplete cyber incident response plan. And by that, a lot of their reaction to the breach was more of a knee-jerk reaction, where they actually did some level of scrambling to actually figure out what to do, and ultimately they actually contracted with a number of third-party vendors to come in because they felt they were adequately prepared for it. Side note, after the incident, they became more prepared for it, so that's a good point to keep in mind. One of the areas that I will say is related to the cyber incident, most of the breaches that we've encountered, we recognize that most of them actually do have a cyber incident plan, but it's not fully tested. It hasn't been fully vetted if you're working with a third-party vendor. it hasn't been fully documented to show the step-by-step process that include having an inherent call tree of all key personnel who need to be notified in case of any kind of breaches, as well as appropriate backups in place and tests to confirm that appropriate backups are in place. So as I had stated earlier from some of the cyber incident findings during our examination, these are the most common recalls of actions or corrective actions we've seen our members incorporate. Data loss prevention, as I stated before, consistent system monitoring. This is a must. We want to make sure that our staff personnel, if particularly you outsource this activity to a third-party vendor, that it actually is being done periodically and checked periodically to ensure that internal as well as external system monitoring is being done. Blocking outbound emails with PII. Most firms actually have a utilizes the Microsoft Outlook or some other email similar to that. Within each kind of email product that's in the industry right now, it actually has a feature that's enable you to encrypt the messages before you send it to your sender. We look for our staff members to identify certain information that they deem to be fairly critical. And if that information is included in an email, that it is flagged or queued to be reviewed by an external group to confirm that it can be sent out. If you don't have such a group in your firm, that you will educate your staff members to encrypt this email by clicking on that little padlock at the top to make sure that the information remains secure from its point of transmission to a point of destination. Authentication, zero trust. This is becoming more and more of a common area within the cyber industry as a whole. It's mainly used for mostly critical or PII-related information. Basically, the general definition of zero trust is if there is any particular area that you might deem to be somewhat more critical or sensitive than some of the area that you normally will access via your regular desktop logon, you might want to consider implementing some form of zero trust, such as multi-factor authentication, single sign-on, or any additional logon authentication process in place, just so if an attacker were to gain access to your desktop profile, it will require them to authenticate again to access any of this critical or PII information. Protecting PII, encryption when sharing critical information. This is more in reference to email, as I had stated before, ensuring that the information is secure in transmission, particularly email and password management. I will actually say that we're seeing more and more of our members incorporating in regards to ensuring that it's secure during transmission. Sharing documents through secure portals. This area is growing more and more as well. In instances where most of our members actually will log into their desktop and then they will access an application or an icon to further log into an environment where they actually will store, process, and distribute information. This is known as a VPN environment where you can log into. This is actually a dedicated secure environment. If you're able to leverage self-hosted environment, it is ideal because it all activity and all sensitive information, you don't have to worry about re-authenticating again once you're inside that VPN environment. It's an ideal area where you can store critical information. You don't have to password protect critical information. However, the feature should have a capability where you are prohibited from downloading any information from that VPN environment. So some of the common industry breaches. These are some of the common industry breaches that we're seeing out there that are fairly common or are growing at an exponential rate. Phishing, basically, I'm sure everyone is familiar with that particular attack technique that's growing out there. It is growing, and unfortunately, it's not going away. It is here to stay, and I will say that most of the attackers out there are gaining some level of creativity by leveraging AI technology to create and tailor their phishing attacks to be very, very convincing. This it can be bypassed by further training, as well as implementing filters in your website content that comes in, as well as ensuring that there is secondary maker and checker if you are sending any information to any recipients. Phishing basically is the same as phishing, except it is via voicemail. Smishing is also gaining momentum where you're receiving texts from on your phone that it could look like it's something you're receiving from your manager or senior officer, but it's actually a smishing link for you to click on. If there is an embedded link on there, I would recommend you contact the recipient directly to confirm that they actually are to receive this information or that you are to execute that link itself before you click on it. Ransomware. The ransomware area is the one area that is growing exponentially. This is also in part due to some of our attackers gaining momentum from leveraging AI technology to further create ransomware attacks. The area that has grown from, I would say, I've read in one statistics where it has grown 15% in the last 3 years, and it is projected to grow even further now that some attackers are leveraging AI technology. Ransomware can be easily prevented by implementing multiple filters, and by filters, I'm defining training, by implementing secure email, by incorporating threat and vulnerability management. All those filters help prevent any kind of ransomware attack. If by chance you were to go through any ransomware attack, consider implementing your incident response plan and making sure that your backups are up to date. Distributed denial of services. Most of these activities related to distributed denial of service attacks in the industry are more related to the availability of technology as well as business operations. It's basically an attack to flood your network and servers for requests that will bring down your business operations or bring it to a standstill. Rarely does it occur. It's going out more and more because we're seeing most firms implementing redundancy as well as failovers if they are able to identify certain attacks of this nature. User account password management, password attacks, and bank drops. Bank drops is becoming a very common area, and it's mostly prevalent with fund transfers related to ACH as well as wire transfers. In a sense, basically, the attacker would send information to a staff member or send information to actually to the bank and verify, pretend that you are the staff member and you are requesting that a wire transfer occur. The bank then checks information that you've sent them, and the attacker then confirms that the account is valid. The bank then sends the wire transfer or ACH transfer into the account that is presented by the attacker, and it's a fraudulent bank account. This is known as a bank drop. We're seeing this occur more and more often in the cyber area as well. The best recourse of action towards these is actually incorporating a form of maker checker in regards to executing any ACH transfer as well as wire transfers. Have a secondary approver executed if in regards to any particular threshold of funds that you deem that should be reviewed by a secondary person. Also, additional multi-factor authentication, such as MFA or two-factor authentication, also helps because the bank will require that, or if the attacker tries to execute that on their own, it will require that additional authentication. Third-party attacks are actually occurring more and more on cloud vendors. Particularly two vendors, I'm not going to say their names, one is has a popular product out there that says search engine, starts with the letter G. And the other vendor starts with the letter A and is a description related to a number of rainforests throughout the global area. Chile, Panama, and Colombia. These are particular vendors who are being attacked by thousands of attackers on a daily basis. The good news is that they actually leverage some of the state-of-the-art technology that's out there, or so they say. But no one is entirely invulnerable to any particular attack. It's best to have contingency plans in place, disaster recovery plans, as well as business continuity plans in place. And as I stated before, artificial intelligence is one key area that is growing momentum, and the attackers are leveraging. The good news is that the existing controls and safeguards that we outline within our interpretive 9070 still applies as a goalpost to prevent that. It's just a matter of implementing it, periodically making updates, and checking periodically. Industry lesson learned and best practices. So I'm not going to spend too much time on this area. I'm sure everyone is familiar with each one of these. Simulated phishing exercises, it's ideal to implement a campaign phishing exercise if you can. Multi-factor authentication, including mobile technology devices, if your firm distributes those, it should be ideal to implement that as well. Third-party risk management, you know, a number of firm members are actually risk deferring that kind of activity to third parties in regards to threat vulnerability management, as well as threat vulnerability monitoring. So that's an ideal area that's a best practice to be leveraged if feasible and applicable to your members and firms. Security event monitoring, as I stated before, as well as any other data loss prevention safeguards that you have done in a risk assessment and deemed ideal to be implemented within your business operation. So in regards to notifying NFA in regards to cyber incidents, these are the three areas that we look for. In regards to incident, it could be one or two or even a combination of three. A side note is that if you contact any state or federal in regards to a cyber incident, it would be ideal to contact NFA as well. And if you feel that a cyber incident occurred with your firm and you're not sure if you should submit a cyber incident, go ahead and submit it. We can contact you and let you know whether or not it is a cyber incident that we need to follow up on or if it's something that we don't consider to be a significant breach. So in regards to certain cyber incidents reported to NFA, as I had stated before, we've had some members who have experienced ransomware attacks. We don't recommend, from our point of view, that payments are made to ransomware attacks. Surprisingly, we're seeing most of our members actually have strong backup systems in place where they do not pay. And it turns out, in some instances, some of these attackers are actually calling a bluff. They will state that they actually have your information, and once the members actually do a check or they actually incorporate a third-party vendor to conduct an assessment, it turns out that the attacker never really obtained any critical information whatsoever. So doing our work on our end ensures that if they come at you with any kind of attack of that nature, you don't have to pay. We don't recommend it. Social engineering, compromised email, phishing attacks, as I stated earlier, third-party vendor breaches. We actually have had some instances where some members actually had third-party vendors who have breached their environment, and they actually notified the members themselves. You don't necessarily have to submit that breach to us, but it would be ideal to send it to us. That way we keep an idea of pattern of certain events or any kind of breaches that's occurring in the industry. Wire transfers, we've had a number of those. Username, password, compromise. So finally, I will say most of our incidents that we've received, breaches that we've received from members, it turns out that they're not deficient in certain controls. It turns out that most of our members actually fairly need to strengthen certain activities in their existing cyber incident operations itself. So that's a good thing to keep in mind. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you for the presentation. A really basic question. What's the NFA's attitude towards firms from a regulatory perspective that might have had a breach from an outside source, but they had reasonable systems in place? I mean, this is a progressive area. Obviously, attackers are getting smarter. AI is getting better. Not to say any firm is perfect, because we know that's not necessarily possible, but reasonable systems were in place. Have the NFA seen situations where this is something new? We understand how this happened, and what's the attitude towards that those firms from a regulatory perspective?
So for most firms who actually has experienced any kind of particular breaches and they have notified us, and I will say most firms actually have incurred certain breaches and they haven't notified us, but they've notified FINRA or the SEC, and then we found out from them, and we're wondering, hey, why didn't you contact us as well? We're also your regulator. We've seen fairly most all breaches that has a common pattern. And that being the case, as I stated before, oftentimes most of our members actually have strong or ideal safeguards in place. What needs to be done is they might say, well, we have this in place, we have email that will filter any critical information, and we have incident response, but they might not have multi-factor authentication or two-factor authentication in place. By notifying us, we can provide further insight in where we feel they might need to consider further strengthening their cyber operations. So to your question, pretty much we haven't seen anything that isn't new, but we actually have provided good insight in further strengthening their environment.
Thank you.
Hi, can I ask you a question about the rule 9079 of the third-party vendor supervision rule? It's always a struggle what to include for the purpose of the rule that are considered vendors that fulfill obligations that's regulatory. So would NFA consider like data vendors? I wouldn't think you would consider Bloomberg, let's say, as a vendor for this purpose, right? But we do rely on data from these vendors to fulfill our obligation.
Well, as Mike will go into further detail in regards to a third party. However, for certain particular vendors, we look for our members to risk classify certain vendors. Bloomberg, you probably obtain more general information that is related to the industry. You probably do not transpose any critical information with them particularly. If that's the case, then you would treat them as a third party in relation to their criticality. So they will be considered somewhat of a, possibly from, depending on what transposition of information you have with them, whether it's a low or medium level vendor, and you would then provide third party oversight in regards from that point.
Thank you.
You mentioned earlier collaboration with other regulators like the SEC and FINRA, and it made me think about 2 years ago, FINRA launched this annual questionnaire that it gives to broker-dealers around vendors that it utilizes, and one of the things that FINRA has started to do is look for commonalities in the industry based on the vendors, critical vendors that they utilize, so that if there is something like a cyber attack, they can proactively reach out to those members that may rely on that third party. Have you given any thought about maybe the collaboration with the industry or proactively reaching out to some of your members in the event of a cyber attack, in the event that you even know about some of the relationships that they have, or even doing something like that with the questionnaire being launched sort of industry-wide to all of your members?
Yes, I recall that FINRA actually had a questionnaire that it was actually posted on their website. They recently have taken that down. FINRA actually performs more of risk-based examinations and reviews. That being said, they actually are doing this in accordance to the nature of their reviews, whether they're going to do further deep dives and do detailed testing, or are they just going to look at policies and so forth. From our point of view, we actually receive feedback from some of our members, not just from cyber breaches, but they actually send us any information related to questions related to cyber in general. And what we normally do is that we will either review that information and make updates to our interpretive where we feel is material, or we will more likely update our FAQ and redirect them to that in regards to further information.
Hi, there's currently a industry working group, primarily made of front office members, to reach out to their vendors collecting numerous information from them. Cyber is a consideration of it. Admittedly, I don't have the questionnaire in front of me, but it was recently provided to the members to reach out to their vendors. We're in a period where we could request, you know, additions to be made to that survey. If you were to pick any, like, two or three, like, real items that you'd want us to get from our vendors, what would you say it should be as part of that outreach?
Oh, well, how much time do we have? I would say in general and not exclusive to. You want to make sure your vendor, if you're transposing any information to that vendor that is considered critical, that they actually are not just following NFA requirements, but also industry best practices as well. Ensuring that any critical or sensitive information is maintained confidentially, as well as incorporating any necessary protection and prevention controls as in place. Depending on the nature of that vendor that you're working with, and I would just say, for example, if it is a critical vendor, you want to ensure that they actually have strong incident response plan and business continuity plans in place if they are managing and transposing data on your behalf. And this should be spelled out and noted within the service level agreement statement of works as well. A number of other areas, but those are the two particulars that I would say that you want to make sure that your vendors are strong on. Other questions? Okay. I'll pass it on to Michael Janet for the third party 9079.
Thank you, Julio. Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Jan. I am a manager in the OTC derivatives department working on examinations. Today, I will be speaking about two particular interpretive notices. One is the third-party service providers, notice 9079, as well as the marketing materials, notice 9077. So I want to take a few minutes to talk about 9079, third-party service providers, as Julio was just mentioning earlier. So this notice applies for all registration categories, which means it's applicable to both U.S. and non-U.S. swap dealers. Therefore, substituted compliance does not apply, and for both the third party and the marketing materials notice, which I will speak about next. NFA noted a large number of firms that were cited for violations, which were in fact based non-U.S. based firms. Now let's talk a bit more about this notice. This notice applies for all new third parties that were onboarded since September of 2021. But note that there's actually still a requirement to perform ongoing due diligence for any third parties that were onboarded, regardless of when they were brought on. Note that the requirements outlined in this notice only provide a framework and is not meant to be prescriptive. This notice does not specifically tell firms how to implement and to comply with each component of the framework. Instead, we ask firms to demonstrate that the manner in which you implement the framework is adequate given your business and particular risks. So similar to the themes that we talked about earlier. The record-keeping part includes documentation to evidence that the process itself has the proper policies and procedures and all major components of this notice. Now let's move on to the common findings. first common finding is the failure to identify all third parties. We are not interested in high-level third parties such as Microsoft Excel and Adobe Acrobat, although you can make a case that there is some regulatory function associated with it, but rather we want you to focus on third parties that perform a particular regulatory function for the swap dealer itself. An example would be a system your firm uses to perform SDR reporting or for surveilling electronic communications. When we speak of third parties, generally we think of ones that are outsourced where the function is performed externally, but what you should still be in scope are third-party software packages or technology that is actually housed internally and incorporated within your swap dealer technology framework. As Julio mentioned, and this is important to understand, is that firms should risk rank their third party so that they can properly determine which ones are critical or rated high that needs to be monitored on a more frequent basis, as well as assessing that third-party applications that are less critical can actually be reviewed at a more infrequent basis, on a longer cycle, basically. So the better you risk rank, the more you can justify which ones you review on a more frequent basis, and the ones that you may say, okay, I'll take a period of time, such as 2 or 3 years, possibly to look at this because it is less critical to my business. Okay. Keep in mind that ongoing monitoring is still a requirement for all third parties, regardless of when they were onboarded. Firms need to not only look at third parties that are negotiated or contracted directly with the third party itself, but also in instances where the swap dealer is utilizing a third party that is actually licensed or contracted through their parent company as well. So keep that in mind as you actually identify which third parties are in scope. The next common finding is that the supervisory framework does not have all the required components of this notice. The main areas include initial risk assessment, the onboarding due diligence, the ongoing monitoring, termination, and record keeping. We often see firms indicate that they perform ongoing due diligence for a third party, but they were unable to evidence this through their documentation. Another common finding that we see for third party agreements is that they don't define the parameters for termination of a third party. So I understand that's a legal process to that, but the reason for that is that you need to focus on how a termination affects your ongoing record keeping, and especially from a data security perspective, because if you're sharing data with them, and especially if it's PII, you want to make sure that that information is kept in a way that you feel comfortable with, either on an ongoing basis or if you are able to make sure that you have that removed from the vendor itself. Okay. We also noted that some firms did not perform or are unable to show that they conducted an initial risk assessment prior to onboarding a new third party. In some instances, they would indicate that the third party was widely used, and therefore initial risk assessment was not required. But for any third party, it presents certain risks to the firm, no matter how prevalent it is within the industry. One last example is when firms identify the criticality of their third parties and commit to reviewing them within a specific time frame, but basically are unable to show that they did that within that time frame. So if you're committing to a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year cycle, make sure that you're able to maintain that and commit to that. Next, we'll move on to marketing materials, notice 9077. Okay. As mentioned similarly for third parties, this notice is applicable to all swap dealers, and therefore substituted compliance does not apply here for non-US-based firms. This means that both U.S. and non-U.S.-based swap dealers need to comply with the components described within this notice. Similar to third parties, NFA noted that a large number of the firms that were cited for violations were also non-U.S.-based firms. The idea behind this notice is to create an adequate supervisory system that includes policies and procedures for reviewing and approving marketing materials, training employees, and record keeping. The firm should identify the individuals that are responsible for contributing, editing, reviewing, and ultimately approving these marketing materials. Each firm should identify internally what documents are considered marketing materials and ensuring that they align with the standards set within this notice. Next, we'll move on to the common findings. The first most common finding is having inadequate policies and procedures. As noted earlier, this means identifying all the people you want to include in the process, ensuring independence between these functions, making sure that the people identified get trained prior to performing any function related to marketing materials, as well as making sure you outline the requirements from a record-keeping perspective, which means that you have copies of all the materials sent and records of the reviews and approvals themselves. You may also need to determine if you need to create policy and procedures for a standard template for materials versus ones that are more customized or tailored for a particular counterparty, and how you review and approve these processes may be different. Another issue is inadequate training that doesn't cover the applicable CFTC and NFA rules and doesn't train on what's considered fair and balanced materials. The training actually also needs to include examples of what is considered a violation so that people can understand what crosses that line. Another common related issue is not having identified individuals complete their training prior to performing this. So we see a lot of individuals that get the training, but a lot of times they've already approved multiple documents even before they got the training. Last but not least, is to maintain full and complete records of all materials and the reviews and approvals prior to distribution, as mentioned earlier. So with that, that's the end of my presentation. I'll take any questions if anyone has any.
Hi, I just have a very quick question. So for personnel to create, review, and approve of marketing materials, as long as they're independent, meaning if the compliance approve of marketing materials, that would be sufficient, right, in addition to, say, front office create and review.
Yeah, that could be a way you can separate the independence of that, yes.
Hi, I have a question related to, you said that internal systems should be classified as third parties. Even if that internal system is like proprietary, like let's say I built my own trading platform or surveillance platform, should that be included as a third party?
That's not what we're discussing here. What we're discussing is if you take a vendor package and you embed it within your own systems.
Okay.
But it's still a vendor package.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Nothing proprietary. No.
Hi. For firms that are based in non-US that have their own home country rules around third-party management, what would you recommend as best practices for making sure that those rules are harmonized with the NFA's expectations when it comes to implementation?
So that's an interesting question. So because a lot of this is based, a lot of the findings that we're seeing are for non-US firms. The minimum standard that you should have for any counterparties that deal within the swap dealer should follow the NFA standards. That being said, the standards for your local regulator may be, we know they're going to be different, but I think there's an analysis that needs to be done to see which ones are the higher standards and decide what you want to do. We're not telling you have to create one process for everything, but at a minimum, you need to at least meet the NFA standards for our purposes.
I have a question. So you mentioned earlier relationships with parent co and vendors and needing to make sure that any relationships, not your exact words, that were onboarded by parent co adhere to the regulations to the extent that you may be using them within the entity that's being regulated. Made me also think about relationships that are provided through parent co to the registrant and the extent to which, from an NFA perspective, you would view any sort of regulatory functions that you outsource to your parent company. For example, if you're a branch and it's your ultimate maybe banking swap dealer parent entity, to what extent would you expect the rules to comply? And that's a really tough question because many of us have enterprise-wide onboarding, systems, processes.
Yeah.
And oftentimes that's concentrated at a head office level, and you wouldn't usually do due diligence on yourself. So I'm curious to know, when you look at it from the registrant's perspective, what the NFA, how they view that.
Yeah, I think for the purposes of this exercise, when we're looking at third parties, it's not necessarily looking at the parent if they're performing that function for you. It's more about the outsourcing of a service, really from a vendor perspective, like a third party outside of your parent. Right? But we can talk about that more in detail if there's some specific concerns you may have in terms of how your organization is structured.
Right here. So from a risk ranking perspective on these vendors, have you seen situations where the NFA disagrees with a firm's risk ranking of, a third-party vendor? Obviously, as you spoke well to, it determines how frequently those systems need to be reviewed based on the critical nature of the vendor. So have you seen situations where maybe firms, you disagree with how they've ranked those particular systems and have, imposed, findings against the firm?
So from a personal level, I have not, but there is that possibility, certainly. If you have a critical trading system that you risk rank and say that that's low and you're not reviewing it every 5 years, there may be something that may be called into question. The idea is not for us to rank it for you, but we use an approach to look at what we consider is reasonable.
All right, thank you.
So I had a question about requiring independence between creator, reviewer, and approver of marketing materials. So what if compliance is the one that's requesting it? Are we expected to have someone else in compliance to approve these changes, or can compliance self-approve essentially? So for example, something on a website that we noticed that is off and we wanted to get it updated.
So I think it depends on your organization, how you have it structured. You certainly should have someone within your organization review the materials. So, for instance, if you have a junior person reviewing it, you probably want someone within the business to look over what you're doing, even if you have someone with compliance that actually does the actual final approvals. So I think it depends on the size of your structure. I don't want to add layers to it. That's unnecessary. But I think you need to look at who's doing the actual creation and reviewing, even if you have someone that's considered independent to do the actual final approvals.
Last question over here.
I just a follow-up question on the hot topic, vendor and cybersecurity. So you mentioned ongoing monitoring. So for your material vendor or your software service that's impacting your critical processes, what's your expectation of the ongoing monitoring from an IT security perspective? For example, are you expecting your IT department to review the pen testing result of the vendors? So things like that. Thank you.
So I would say the best approach from that is that if it is considered a most critical vendor from your firm's point of view, that you try to be as engaged and involved with their activities. It could include obtaining pen test results for them. It could include obtaining SOC 2 information from them. It could include holding quarterly meetings with them in regards if they're doing any threat and vulnerability monitoring on your behalf. You want to make sure that they are keeping in touch with not just the activities that's outlined within the contract that you have with them, but they actually are in tune with any outside external threats on behalf of your firm.
Thank you. How should we view vendors that are regulated by the CFTC or the SEC or some other regulatory body versus those that are not from a third-party risk management perspective?
So I don't know that I can say that there's any particular vendors that I know of that are directly regulated by the CFTC that would fall into this category. If you have one in mind, we can talk about it. But I would say that you should look at it from your perspective, right, from the firm's perspective, and risk rank it for yourself, as opposed to saying, well, someone else is already looking at it, so therefore I don't need to do that, because we do see some of that, and that's creating a bit more risk for yourself. and need be, right? Don't rely on someone else to do what you feel comfortable with in terms of bringing on a new vendor. Okay. So with that, pass it on to Rena. Let's speak about interpretive notices and other applicable notices related to risk. Rena?
Thank you, Michael. My name is Rena Callis. I'm a senior quantitative risk manager. I work in the risk group of the OTC derivative department. So first, I'm going to start with the swap valuation dispute. In summer 2017, the CFTC approved NFA interpretative notice to NFA compliance rule 249, which, among other things, specified the type of swap valuation dispute that must be reported. It standardized the information that swap dealers are required to report to NFA. A list of required data points can be found in NFA Notice to Member I-1713, issued on July 20, 2017. The interpretative notice became effective for dispute notice required to be filed on or after January 2, 2018. This interpretative notice requires swap dealer to file notice of swap valuation dispute that are greater than 20 million and have not been resolved within the time frame specified in the regulation. This time frame is 3 business days for a dispute that the counterpart is another swap dealer, or 5 business days where the counterpart is non-swap dealer. Disputes have to be submitted on initial margin, variation margin, and transaction or portfolio valuation where collateral is no exchange. All swap dealers they must submit to NFA the required filing for all in-scope dispute as set in the interpretative notice. Also, swap dealers are required to amend a previous file notice if the amount decreases under 20 million. Termination notices are required to be filed on the 15th business day of the month or the following business day if the 15th is a weekend or a bank holiday. Or this termination notice can be filed the last business day of the month based on the dispute amount of the reporting date. So one reminder is that this reporting requirement apply to all in-scope dispute of all swap dealer member, regardless of any CFTC determination of the cross-border application of the CFTC regulation. So specifically, the firm must submit to NFA each reportable swap valuation dispute, including those where the counterparty is a non-US swap dealer. Finally, all disputes they have to be submitted to NFA, regardless of the drivers of the dispute. So, for example, if you have a dispute that is driven by operational issue, this has to be submitted to NFA. So, I think you can talk. So next, I'm going to talk about risk data filing. In January of 2018, NFA started receiving standardized market and credit risk data. The notice I-1710 identified a list of metrics related to market and credit risk that provide NFA with important information regarding the swap dealer risk profile. Some of the metrics include VAR, stress VAR, credit valuation adjustment or expected credit loss, and current exposure after collateral. So all the risk data file metrics should be computed with the same methodology and system used for the firm daily internal risk management calculation, and therefore they have to be subjected to the same control. Also, NFA expects each swap dealer to implement control to ensure the completeness and the accuracy of each risk metric submitted to NFA as a part of this filing requirement. Appropriate control are included but not limited to validation activity, backtesting, reconciliation, price validation, verification testing, and other ongoing monitoring activity. Finally, I just want to remind that reporting level and scope must be in line with the firm election. So each OSBOPO dealer has the option of selecting the reporting level and scope of the activity in the pre-filing questionnaire. But once this has been selected, the OSBOPO dealer must report all metrics at that level on an ongoing basis. So the OSBOPO dealer is not permitted to change the reporting level or scope of activity from month to month without a prior approval from NFA. I think you can move to the RNA. Swap dealer members also are subject to CFTC minimum capital requirement. They must maintain regulatory capital as defined under the banking holding regulation. The minimum capital capital requirement include the unclear swap margin amount, also known as risk margin amount. We can move to the next slide. So, according to the CFTC letter 2114, swap dealer may use a model to compute the risk margin amount without obtaining an approval from NFA or the CFTC. Swap dealer member that use model in their internal risk management framework to comply with the minimum capital requirement, they do not need an approval by regulator. They must be approved internally by the firm model risk management. So the firm must subject this model to the swap dealer internal model risk management control, such as the swap dealer independent model validation, and at minimum they have to obtain a positive opinion from model risk management on the inclusion of the extending RMA scope in the model. The firm must subject this model to ongoing performance monitoring and also to an audit processes. So basically the expectation is that the swap dealer is able to conclude that the RMA amount is adequate, and in order to be able to draw this conclusion, the model must be part of the firm monitoring framework. So the good practice will be to conduct monitoring based on 23.154b5 requirement, but we believe that at minimum ongoing performance monitoring for RMA should include backtesting against PNL and risk not initial margin assessment. This is to ensure that the firm understands the risk that might be not captured by the model. Ultimately, it's a responsibility of each firm to identify appropriate control around the RMA amount. Finally, all the position used in the RMA calculation must be included and adequately represent in the model on the monitoring performance. So that is the end. I'm happy to take any questions you might have at this point.
Well, thank you. I guess we'll transition into our next session, sorry. If you want to get up and stretch just a little bit as we take a minute to transition to the next session. Thank you.